This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
The search for energy continues to be one of the driving forces of our economy and policy. Now, the University of Massachusetts is offering a doctoral program in wind power to speed the development of this source of renewable energy.
I think there's a pretty obvious need in the sense that we're really lagging behind in the development of offshore wind in the U.S.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk to a pair of professors at UMass about the program. We'll also celebrate NaNoWriMo, but first we'll tell you what it is. And we'll spend an academic minute sharing some shocking news about alcohol. Seems it affects your interactions with strangers. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. There are a lot of issues to deal with when setting up a wind power facility. Engineering? Sure. Environmental? Of course. But there are also social issues, gaining public support for a project that'll be making a fairly large change in the local landscape. To prepare for all of these issues, the University of Massachusetts at Amherst has begun an integrative graduate education and research traineeship in offshore wind energy program. The program was started in August of 2011 with a grant from the National Science Foundation and will eventually train 24 doctoral students in 5 years. Here to talk about the program is Dr. Matthew Lackner, an assistant professor of mechanical and industrial engineering, and Dr. Aaron Baker, an associate professor of industrial engineering at UMass Amherst. We spoke about the program recently, and I asked what need this program was designed to fill.
Yeah, I guess there's probably two answers to that question. The first is that it's tradition here. We've had a wind program. It was founded in the early 70s by a guy, his name was Captain Bill Hieronymus. He was a Navy captain. And he was a really cool guy. He had this vision to power the whole East Coast from floating offshore wind turbines and make hydrogen and run like a hydrogen economy. And this is, you know, again, early 70s. So he's way, way ahead of his time. So he actually started a wind program here, which has been in existence ever since. And for a long time was more or less the only wind program in the U.S. or one of the only ones. And a lot of our graduates went on to, from the 70s and 80s, to kind of found the U.S. wind industry. So there's the history of it, which is we've always had this program, and it's generally been, you know, one of the best known and biggest and kind of more well-respected ones. More recently, you know, offshore wind has been developed in Europe for over 20 years. Cape Wind in the U.S. was proposed like maybe 12 years ago, give or take. But there's not a single offshore wind turbine in the U.S. There's 3 gigawatts of offshore wind in Europe, and China's building offshore wind. So I think there's a pretty obvious need in the sense that we're really lagging behind in the development of offshore wind in the U.S. And so the goal of this IGRD program was to address that by looking at not just the technical barriers, which is kind of the things that I tend to be interested in as a mechanical engineer, but also how the environmental and social and political and economic factors come into play, and to make a program where our students kind of learn about all of those things and get a broader understanding of the context of offshore wind along with the depth of their specific PhD research.
We see that, you know, wind is an important and growing resource, and especially given the news actually today that we're seeing that greenhouse gas emissions are still climbing. Wind is really promising as its cost is very close to fossil-based electricity generation, but it's emission-free. But in the U.S., we've seen a major barrier to siting wind farms for actually getting people to agree to allow the wind farm to go up. And it's especially difficult to site them in places near where the electricity is demanded. And it turns out that siting transmission is even more difficult, so it's important to site them somewhere near where there's electricity needed. And there's a lot of wind off the coast, especially here on the East Coast, and there's a lot of demand nearby. And so it seems like a really good solution to put wind farms in the ocean. But that has also been very hard to site. I mean, we saw with our kind of classic examples, the Cape Wind project. So our project is aimed at trying to solve this problem by bringing together people from different fields to address kind of the multiple barriers. So it includes engineers looking at designing the offshore turbines and potentially, say, floating turbines, environmental scientists working on understanding the potential impacts on the natural world, and social scientists taking a policy perspective. And so that's why I see that's really the need that we're filling, is getting these people to work together and to think in different ways to maybe put together new ideas about how to get wind energy, and especially offshore wind energy, growing in the U.S.
It seems like the technical knowledge is already there. It's the knowledge of dealing with the not-in-my-backyard syndrome is what needs to be increased.
Yes and no. There's definitely, I mean, Cape Wind, the issue has certainly not been the fact that we don't have offshore wind turbines that could be installed and operated at that site. You're absolutely right. There's conventional technology that would work, and it was the NIMBY and social issues that have held that up. That said, I mean, technology can always get better, right? And the cheaper it becomes and the more reliable it becomes, the more opportunities there are for development, and the you know, the cheaper the electricity that ratepayers have to pay for it. So I wouldn't say I'd say it's a mature technology, but, you know, airplanes have been mature for a long time, but there's still lots of research going into improving them and trying to make the technology even better. So there's still a lot of room for improvement, especially in going to deeper waters farther offshore. That's a big focus of mine, is floating offshore wind turbines, which would be used 20 or 30 miles offshore, much deeper waters, whereas Cape Wind is within, you know, 5 or 10 miles offshore, and the water's relatively shallow. But in that specific instance, you're right, it's the social issues that really have been the driving factor.
Part of it, I think, may have been that people who support wind farms are just so excited about them. They think everyone's going to be really excited about the wind farm, and they just kind of go in and say, let's put a wind farm here. And they haven't really worked with the idea that they should first maybe think about talking to the community and trying to see which communities are most interested in the wind farms. So it's kind of on both sides, that the developers, I think, have had kind of over-enthusiastic and have failed to kind of go in and do the work on the ground that needs to be done.
I mean, I know some of the objections to are just for, you know, they don't want to take a look out onto the coastline and see these things. I remember driving a couple of years ago. I took a drive to the west, and I saw something in the distance. I mean, I was in one of those flat states. Mm-hmm. And it took, I mean, almost an hour for me to actually get up to what turned out to be a wind farm. I mean, they're just massive, massive structures.
They are big, yeah. A 5-megawatt wind turbine has like a 90-meter hub height, so a little under 300 feet, and about 160-meter diameter, so that's close to 500 feet diameter. So, the blades are a good chunk, two-thirds, three-quarters of a football field long. They're really big. The visual objections, it's hard to argue visual taste, right? Something's pretty to one person can be ugly to someone else. And so, you know, I guess I can sort of understand, you know, if you don't want to see it, you don't want to see it. If you put them 50 miles offshore, they won't be able to be seen. That's my understanding, is they're basically, you can't see them at that point. If they're 5 miles offshore, you can definitely see them. They kind of look like massive ships, or maybe a little bit bigger. To me, it's not a totally invalid reason to oppose wind, but I think it's not a strong enough reason to actually prevent these developments from going through. I mean, the fact is we need to get power from somewhere. I think one of the issues is you ask people, you know, do you want wind turbines or no wind turbines? And they say, well, I guess no wind turbines. But you don't say, do you want wind turbines or do you want, you know, a coal plant or an oil plant or a natural gas plant down the street? And given that choice, I think wind becomes a lot more compelling. It's only in a vacuum that it seems more reasonable to oppose it. But people keep using more energy and more power, and we got to get it from somewhere. So in my mind, offshore wind is a pretty benign, and, you know, I'm obviously extremely biased, but I find them to be kind of cool and beautiful. And I mean, one of the issues is it's hard to build any new energy developments in this country except for natural gas, but it's hard to build new coal. And we're just the way our laws work, we allow people to have a big say in the process, and people can, you know, hold up developments that they don't like, and vocal minorities can definitely be very effective at that. And, you know, there haven't been a new nuclear plant built in the country, I think, in almost 30 years. And so those strategies that have been used to oppose nuclear power have been used to oppose wind pretty effectively, at least in New England.
The program at UMass right now, this is a doctoral program?
Yes, this particular program is funded by the National Science Foundation, and it's aimed at PhD students especially.
And when they graduate, they will have a PhD in what?
So that actually depends. Each of them will get a PhD in their field. So we have a number of students in mechanical engineering right now, a couple of students in civil engineering, a few students in a department called environmental conservation, and so their PhD will be in that. A student in planning, and so his PhD will be in planning, and then we've got one in political science. So each student will get their PhD in their discipline, but they will have worked on, you know, this really interesting, very interdisciplinary project and be an expert in offshore wind energy.
When you take a look at the ecological assessment and environmental monitoring portion of this, what are the basic areas that you're looking at there? Where did the study need to go?
Well, I mean, right now for offshore, there's not a huge amount of information out there. And so it's really trying to figure out what's out there, what the holes are, and filling those holes in. But in particular, we have people working on birds, so understanding, you know, bird migrations and that kind of thing. And so, you know, where are the really bad places to put them, and, you know, where are the places that are not so bad. And then really understanding the marine life is very interesting. It turns out that putting in the offshore wind turbines can actually have some very positive effects on marine life. It has what's called an artificial reef, where, you know, you put the wind turbine bases in there and they start to develop a lot of growth around them, and that can actually attract a number of animals and you get kind of a new ecosystem. And so so we're interested in studying that as well as, you know, negative impacts on sea life, I guess, in general.
Wind energy is growing in the U.S. Do you see it growing much further?
I think so. I hope so. I think eventually. I think a lot of the question is how long it's going to take. But I'm pretty sure that we'll eventually see a lot more wind energy because it's economic and it's clean. And so it really makes sense. The question is, how quickly are we going to move forward? And so with our project, we're hoping by, you know, educating kind of a new generation of people to work on these problems and think about them holistically, we'll be able to move this development a little faster than it would go without that.
Your release says that you're hoping to train 24 doctoral students over the next 5 years. Are you looking beyond that to maybe expanding this if you see some success?
Sure. We're definitely interested in it. We're developing classes and kind of seminar series and interactions for the students. So we're really developing a framework. And so beyond the 5 years, yeah, I think that we would hope we would bring in more people. It's that the NSF project will actually pay for that many PhD students. And so once we go past the 5 years, then it means that the individual professors that are involved in the study will need to be getting their own projects and funding the projects. But we're hoping that this is going to build a really nice base, and so people will continue to work in this interdisciplinary way and making sure that their students are getting this cross-cutting interactions with students from other fields.
Do you feel any eyeballs on you from other schools just wanting to see how you do on this?
That's a good question. I'm not sure. I mean, I think people are definitely very interested in this field and more generally in renewable energy and these kind of interdisciplinary projects. And so we'll see how successful we're able to be. And I think we will be successful. And then I think people will be very interested.
I think that's already happened. You know, while we were one of the few programs for a long time in the probably in the 80s and even into the early 90s, there's been a huge increase in sort of interest in wind from lots of universities all over the country. And so there are tens of wind programs now at different schools doing really great research and teaching classes. And I think we're probably still one of the biggest ones, and I think almost for sure we're the oldest, but we're definitely not alone anymore. And you know, we collaborate, or at least I do, with researchers at some other schools. And then, you know, compared to Europe, we're all trying to catch up to the Europeans in terms of their academic wind programs that they have. So still a ways to go, I think.
When do you think you'll see it? When do you think you'll see one offshore in the U.S.?
Hopefully next year. It looks like the Block Island project in Rhode Island, there's two phases, and the first one I think is 5 or 6 turbines. And those, I believe, as far as I know, are going to be installed in the summer of 2013. Cape Wind, I think they're gunning for 2013 or 2014 to start installing and commissioning their turbines. And that one, I hope, gets built and I think has a better than 50-50 shot, I think. But I would not make a definitive statement on Cape Wind's prospects just because the opposition has been so intense for so long.
You've got a little history to draw on from that one.
Yeah, right. There's 12 years of history of empirical evidence to show that it's not easy to build a wind farm at that location. But it does appear like the Block Island project is going to happen. The phase one, I think, probably next year, and then phase two a couple years after that.
Dr. Matthew Lackner is an assistant professor of mechanical and industrial engineering. And Dr. Aaron Baker is an associate professor of industrial engineering at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. Still to come, you might not have realized it, but November was NaNoWriMo. What is that? You'll know next on The Best of Our Knowledge. got any questions or comments about the best of our knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past shows again, you can find us online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. You can start your own archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for the best of our knowledge, number 1161. This is the best of our knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. The month of November has been designated National Novel Writing Month, or as the cool kids call it, NaNoWriMo. The challenge is for writers to get to work on their novels and write 50,000 words before the end of the month. Reporter David Berner went to a studio loft on the northwest side of Chicago, where writers of all levels came together last month for nights of marathon writing, hoping to try to knock out the next bestseller.
It's early on a Monday night in a building along the L tracks on Chicago's northwest side. In a second floor loft here above a gym, people gather for what's being called a write-in.
Well, I'm writing a book that's somewhat true, but I'm kind of changing a few things around to make it more interesting, I guess.
This is Story Studio in Chicago, a writer's workshop. Hardwood floors, comfy couches, and overstuffed chairs. There's a distinct smell of coffee in the air. Some pizza and chips on a table. It's busy here, but in a quiet sort of way. And in nearly every corner and tucked away spot, there are writers, like Donna, leaning into their laptops.
I just needed to get out of the house to write. And I said, you know what, don't procrastinate any longer. Get your butt out the door and come and sit and write.
Donna works in the mental health industry, but she doesn't want to tell anyone exactly where. It would give away the true stories that help shape her manuscript. A story she describes as the hell of dating at the office.
Everyone always told us, don't date anyone you work with. And it's just about how I've stuck to that, waited about 2 years before I wound up giving in, and then all the hell that has pursued from doing that, and why I probably should never have done that in the first place.
So that's what the story is about?
Yeah. And sex. Not necessarily love. Love and sex.
The stories being shaped here are as diverse as the people. There's a college student writing a fantasy about how goblins created the Great Depression. A young mother with a story of war-torn love. A college teacher named Jess writing about one very troubled student.
He seemed very angry about the class and about me and was very hostile. And you come here every day and hassle me, so what the hell, you know? And so in the end, I'm killing myself off.
This write-in is part of what is affectionately called NaNoWriMo around here, or just NaNo for short.
Being in the same physical space with other people who have kind of the same goals as you, I think is a real motivator.
National Novel Writing Month was started in 1999. Group of 21 writers in San Francisco. They wanted to challenge each other to write 50,000 words in 1 month, meaningful literary words. Since then, an organization was formed and more than 200,000 people have officially taken part in NaNoWriMo. So far this year, the organization says it has logged more than 1.5 million words. Where are you?
3,000 words.
It's about 20,000.
Only a few hundred. I mean, I'm
very
behind. Yeah.
This write-in is one of a few here in November at Story Studio. As many as 60 different stories are expected to come out of the work that's done here this month. About halfway through the five-hour write-in, Ian walks in and looks for a place to plug in his laptop.
A year ago, tried to do NaNoWriMo and then failed, and I thought maybe if I come to one of these things, I'll like work my way into it, because the best way to get through writing is to kind of lock the keys in the trunk and then work your way out from there.
Ian says the energy of everyone in one place writing together creates what he calls an imagination orgasm.
I just want to get some words on the page just to plow through it, because I've been lazy.
Most publishers would consider 50,000 words a shortish novel, but still a novel, and that's the goal. Get in those 50,000 words and then look for a chance to get the story out there somewhere. Success from NaNoWriMo has been documented. The first draft of the bestseller, Water for Elephants, was written during Novel Writing Month. down a narrow hallway and into a room with desks fashioned into a large square shape. Things are a little more formal, more like a classroom. And inside are four women. One is Jennifer, a published author of a romance novel who is working on another.
It's set in the Regency era, and it is about Lady Charlotte, who has been jilted by her fiancé and has developed a plan to fake an engagement to win him back.
Next to her is Rachel, who says her story is based on a dating experiment she conducted.
I decided to meet 50 guys in a year. Guys that I would actually consider dating, not just a random guy.
50, though?
50. In one fantastic story.
Although some here are just beginning their word journey, logging in maybe 300 words, Rachel, writing under a pen name, Reed Stone, is already kicking literary butt.
55-4.
You're over the limit?
I am. I quit my job, started organizing, and started writing.
And although Rachel has written more than she needs to for NaNoWriMo, she figures she's going to try to finish her story before the end of the month.
That story comes from reporter David Berner in Chicago. Here's a news bulletin you might need if you're attending an office holiday party. Alcohol can affect your interactions with other humans. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Welcome to the Academic Minute. I'm Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. For many, social interactions are more natural and comfortable over a bottle of wine or a cold beer. Michael Sayette, professor of psychology at the University of Pittsburgh, uncorks some research that's finally serving up what many have known for a long time.
Presumably, if we had a better understanding of people's motives for drinking, we could improve our ability to identify who is at increased risk for developing drinking problems. Although surveys have repeatedly revealed that people claim to drink in order to improve their social experiences, it has been surprising that decades of laboratory research have failed to produce consistent support for this expectation. Though most participants in alcohol studies are social drinkers who rarely drink alone, most studies have only tested participants one at a time. These participants likely experience alcohol quite differently when they are drinking alone than when they are drinking in a group setting. Our research examined the effects of alcohol among three strangers, drinking together using sophisticated observational methods and methodological advances derived from small group research. The current study was much larger than prior investigations. It required coding more than 34 million separate frames of video and provided the most comprehensive experimental evidence yet to support the premise that alcohol can serve as a social lubricant. Furthermore, the group formation paradigm used in this study offers a valid paradigm for testing which individuals may be at heightened risk for relying on these social effects of alcohol. Together with Dr. Casey Cresswell, we have found that individuals with a particular variant of a dopamine-regulating gene, known as DRD4, are especially sensitive to the effects of alcohol on perceived social bonding. Our findings indicate that we must appreciate the powerful effects that alcohol can exert on our social interactions, and we need to guard against allowing this attractive effect to nudge us into potentially hazardous drinking habits.
That was Michael Sayette of the University of Pittsburgh.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Shartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.